844-321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. I'm joined by street reporter Jeremiah Hayden to talk about his recent article, Grants Passed to Provide Basic Relief for Homeless Residents Following Legal Settlement. The city won a Supreme Court case allowing cities to punish homeless people. And an Oregon law says cities must act reasonably despite federal provocations. Hi, Jeremiah. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So first off, will you give me a little background about Grants Pass versus Johnson, which is the lawsuit that Grants Pass won that set sort of a national precedent for how cities enforce homeless ordinances?
Grants Pass, yeah, took its case all the way to the Supreme Court. It was sued in 2018 over, you know, essentially the lawyers argued that Grants Pass was making it impossible to sleep anywhere without a home in Grants Pass without violating its laws. And the city was just trying to punish people for being poor. And the Supreme Court basically agreed with that. They determined that it did not violate the Eighth Amendment, the cruel and unusual punishments clause of the Eighth Amendment. And, you know, it's interesting because that gave basically, you know, permission to cities, you know, all across America that it is just fine if you decide that you want to punish people for being in poverty and not having a place to live, and your city has created ordinances that bar them from sleeping in any place in your city, you know, then that's totally fine. But in the Supreme Court's opinion, which was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, he sort of alluded to this state law and said, you know, while we think it is fine for cities to punish homeless residents, there is a state law in Oregon that requires cities to be objectively reasonable when they're regulating homelessness. Oregon just happens to be the only state that has those kinds of protections. So there's a bit of a coincidence here in the fact that Grants Pass took its case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, sure, go ahead. And all of these other cities, you know, across the West, across the nation, who had been arguing that they needed to punish homeless residents to address their homelessness crises, they all sort of quote unquote benefited from that decision. But Grants Pass itself was sort of used by them in this way, but still has to abide by this state law.
Yeah. So can you tell me more about the Oregon state law that you're referring to?
This law was passed by the Oregon legislature in 2021 when now Governor Tina Kotek was the Speaker of the House. And it basically said, and this is a little bit vague, that laws regulating homelessness must be objectively reasonable and they must take into account the totality of the circumstances that people are experiencing, right? So like if you don't have enough shelter beds, for instance, in your city for people to go to, if you're trying to compel them there and say you can't stay here but you can go there, if you don't have enough beds for that, lawyers will look at that and say this is objectively unreasonable. That's what sort of happened again in this case under that claim that Grants Pass just settled. It is vague, and it's sort of meant to be vague in a certain way. I talked to Tom Stenson from Disability Rights Oregon, who had filed this case, and you know, I've talked to a handful of lawyers over the last couple of years about this thing, and nobody can describe to me what exactly objectively reasonable is. It's sort of one of those things, it's a legal term of art that lawyers will get in the room in front of a judge, and they will determine whether or not something is objectively reasonable. But the state law is meant to enshrine the Martin v. Boise decision that said you cannot punish people for being homeless if you do not have sufficient shelter space for them. And that's how Grants Pass kind of ended up back here again, despite its big win in its Supreme Court case, Grants Pass v. Johnson.
What are some of the things specifically that Grants Pass is being like required to do by the state?
After it won its case, Grants Pass went on to basically open these sites. They were, Street Roots covered this quite a bit at the time. Just about a year ago, there was like a 104 degree heat wave coming through, and they basically opened one big site, didn't provide any water. There was no shade. They eventually provided some outhouses for people to use, and they were just these very inhumane conditions during a heat wave. And they kicked everyone out of the local parks and said, you can go to this one spot. Then they opened this other little tiny spot, also no water, no amenities whatsoever. And people were required to move back and forth between those two spaces. So a local doctor at the time, Bruce Murray, who works with the local organization Mint in Grants Pass, started talking to the homeless residents there, many of whom have disabilities that would preclude them from moving all the way across town. It was like a mile and a half across town to the other site every 96 hours. And that is how Disability Rights Oregon ended up in this case, was by saying that this is, first of all, objectively unreasonable for anyone to live under those circumstances, but it's particularly unreasonable for people with disabilities who are expected to move all over the place. It was on gravel, so people couldn't take their wheelchairs. You know, if people had no mobility devices, they literally couldn't get into the one place they were legally allowed to stay. Under threat of being arrested and being fined. So, it's not like just, hey, would you please go there? This is like police officers showing up. And so now, it's kind of basic stuff. It's not some big win where all of a sudden, homeless residents are able to have, affordable housing, for instance. There's nothing here that has made in this settlement that makes things really, any sort of like solution to the issues that residents are facing down there. But Grants Pass does have to invest some money. They have to send, I think, $60,000 in grants to a local service provider. I would guess that would be Mint, because there are not a lot of service providers in Grants Pass. They have to have space for at least 150 homeless residents to stay. They can't require, people with doctor's notes requesting legal or reasonable accommodations under the ADA. They can't force those people to move so frequently. And they have to provide potable water and restrooms for people at these sites. So it's basic stuff. It is a success in the sense that Grants Pass cannot just do whatever it wants to homeless people. And at the same time, as Tom Stenson from Disability Rights Oregon told me, they have a long ways to go still, but they've come a long ways since where they were at January when the lawsuit was filed.
Yeah. So, I mean, while it is like the most basic, bare human rights, at least it's something for the people there. Do you think that this law in Oregon looks like it's going to stay in place?
It's a good question. There were some real threats, I think, in this last legislative session. I know a lot of people are keeping an eye on what You know, honestly, Democrats and Republicans alike might do to overturn that state law. And it seems to be intact. It made it through that last legislative session. I'm not sure under, you know, new threats from the Trump administration regarding funding for, you know, cities and states around homelessness. Trump has, you know, really been going a little bit wild since, you know, calling in the military and all of these agencies into Washington, D.C., which seems to be a bit of a, I'd say trial balloon, but I think we're here. So, you know, for other cities and specifically trying to equate homelessness and crime, and that's why he's sending in all of these, the military to come take care of some, you know, thing that he's claimed without evidence, is an issue here. So, you know, to, I guess to get back to your question, like the state law is, it's two for two lawyers that have brought a claim under a city being objectively unreasonable in its homelessness ordinances have both won. The other one was in Portland in 2023. And, you know, people, lawyers, you know, community members, advocates all across the state. Tom Stenson reminded me that they're all welcome to bring these kinds of cases if they perceive that, you know, the laws in their own cities are unreasonable. But for now, it's still there. It's pretty basic standard, but it is there, and it has at least somewhat raised the standards for people, you know, in poverty and living while homeless in other cities so far.
Yeah. Is it still the only, are we still the only state with a law like this?
I believe so. I would need to look into that a little bit further, but I believe we really are the only state, and that if anything, you know, most states seem to be going the other way.
Anything else you wanted to add about this?
Well, I do think this is really important in this national context. I mean, Oregon has passed a law that, you know, it's really hard to get anybody, you know, even the civil rights director, you know, at the attorney general's office, you know, in Oregon at the ODOJ, like, are not like really excited about opening up new cases that protect homeless residents. People are very overwhelmed by the administration coming after anyone that it perceives, you know, just to be undesirable in the world that they're trying to create. And, you know, it's always worth noting that, you know, BIPOC people, you know, queer people are always, and people with disabilities, you know, are overrepresented in homelessness statistics. And that just so happens to be the exact same people that the Trump administration is, you know, trying to push into jails, you know, in every other way, and take away all of the support systems for those very same people, those same demographics. So it's all kind of part of the same effort from the federal level to do, you know, this kind of violence on people. And I think it's important to remember that, because if there's one thing I've learned in covering homelessness, you know, here and statewide and, you know, kind of at the national level, is that people remind me over and over again that this can happen to anyone. And so it, you know, even just in an individual kind of way, if empathy doesn't work, there's always fear, you know, that it could be you next. So I think that's a really important thing, as the administration is, quote unquote, cracking down on people lacking a support system.
Without providing the support system.
Well, yeah, and while taking away the support system.
Yeah. It's pretty bizarre. I'm curious if there's anything that, despite the number of things that are happening against human rights and against, you know, basic things for people, I'm curious if there's anything that is giving you hope right now.
It is certainly hard to find. And, you know, as reporters, we go out and try to find, you know, good hard evidence of facts that, you know, will say a certain, you know, say one thing or another and report on those facts. you know, sort of factually, it might be challenging to find, but there are these small wins that are happening for people on some level. There are some structures that are sort of being upheld, and you know, to me, the more kind of, I guess, anecdotal stuff can give me hope. I think there are some people who seem to understand that in this moment, they're capitulating is not something that is effective in pushing back on an administration such as this. I see people standing up boldly and saying the truth. I see reporters all over reporting things truthfully despite threats from this administration, not only this administration, but you know, threats you know, in the Middle East, from, you know, Israel killing journalists. All of these things are very depressing and they're very challenging, and at the same time, those journalists go out every single day knowing that they must report the truth in a time like this. They don't know how to do it any other way, and there's some sort of hope in that, you know, the resignation and the ability to just sort of like embody a role to tell the truth, even when things are very challenging and there's a lot to be afraid of. So I find a lot of both fear and hope in that at the same time, but I think it's good to hold a couple things at the same time. So, you know, people can win. And, you know, even if it's a small lawsuit, you know, in a small town, in a small state, in a small country, those things are still making a really positive impact for people.
Yeah, thank you. Where can people find this article?
The best place to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood and accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Sweet. Thanks so much for your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks, Hannah.
You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Rebecca Ivy Galvan started a petition to end Portland's sister city relationship with Ashkelon, Israel, in an effort to take away support for Israel's genocide on Gaza.
I'm a Portland resident. I've lived here for about 13 years. My background is in community healthcare and nursing. I've been involved in different advocacy throughout my adult life, and for the last 22 months, I've been very passionate about Palestinian human rights and ending this genocide. I'm not particularly affiliated with any group. I'm not representing anyone, but I do work closely with other groups that are prominent in Portland for pro-Palestinian work. Jewish Voice for Peace, Rainbow Block, Al Alda, and others.
Thank you. And so you are the creator or one of the creators of this petition to end the sister city ties with Portland in Oregon and a city in Israel called Ashkelon. Mm-hmm. Now, this city was founded on Palestinian land on top of a once Palestinian city, Al Mashdal Ashkelon, in the violent 1948 Nakba. And these systems of oppression have also been sustained by policies within the city. And you folks say that this alliance of the sister city ties between Portland and Ashkelon is not just a diplomatic relation, but also an endorsement of this kind of violence. So can you tell me about this alliance and how it is an endorsement of this genocide?
Yeah, so you just summed it up beautifully, really. Al-Majdal Ascalon is an historic Palestinian village. It's ancient. Palestinians have lived there and thrived for thousands of years. It was violently occupied during the Nakba between the years of 1945 and 1950. Thousands of Palestinian residents were forcibly dispossessed and displaced. A lot of them were moved into the Gaza Strip, where they have suffered under apartheid and genocide ever since. The Portland sister city relationship with occupied Ashkelon was formed in 1987, so it's existed in Portland for a long time. And sister city programs are typically about human connection, but it does involve significant amounts of money as a municipal program. And through City Hall, we do cultural and economic programming with the Portland Ashkelon Sister City Association. They have monthly meetings with the mayor's office, for example, are involved with Rose Festival activities, and have a permanent place in an art installation in Pioneer Square, directly across from Pioneer Courthouse, that points towards, it's one of those signs that points towards different locations and gives you the distance 6,000 miles this way to our sister city, Ashkelon. And what I mean by this is an endorsement of things like ethnic cleansing and stuff is just because of that history that's factual and very well documented of violent dispossession and displacement and illegal occupation in Palestinian territory. Ashkelon has other cities that it has a similar sister city relationship with in the United States, Sacramento, Baltimore, and Portland, I believe are the three. And what that says to me is it is it's an attempt at normalization. Make a lot of friends, and then no one will know that your existence is illegitimate.
Right. Yeah. Can you tell me about some of the policies that have sort of reinforced the systematic dehumanization of Palestinians in Ashkelon?
Yeah. Palestinians, Arabs in Ashkelon and in Greater Israel face a lot of discrimination in work, in housing, in access to services. It's an apartheid system, and being Arab makes you a lower class citizen in these areas. In 2014, for example, the mayor of Ashkelon barred Palestinian workers from city projects explicitly. And that was condemned widely as a racist policy.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah, thanks. If you could tell me about how the city of Ashkelon is currently putting power into the current genocide in Gaza. Kind of what role they play.
Yeah, so they play several roles, and most prominent probably is that they are a port city. The port of Ashkelon plays a huge role in the movement of military cargo, particularly petroleum and oil handling. The port handles large tankers and has infrastructure to manage fuel and other products. Fuel deliveries arrive daily. Jet fuel, for example, is very problematic. Otherwise, in terms of their military or their role in the genocide of Gaza, is just their location. They are 10 minutes outside of the Gaza Strip. And so they are, where you could say an IOF soldier might go take their lunch break. And there's a huge military culture in Ashkelon in general. Yeah.
Thanks. Have you had any communications with folks from Ashkelon?
No. However, I have had communication with Palestinians who know about Ashkelon. Palestinians from Israel, Palestinians from the West Bank, Palestinians here in Portland are very familiar with Ashkelon and its context.
Yeah. How would ending this partnership encourage an end to the genocide in Gaza?
It fits into the boycott and divest framework by enacting social consequences for unacceptable behavior. It's part of isolating the pariah state of Israel and holding it accountable for its crimes. The bottom line is that Portlanders just don't want to be associated with a colonial city that is so deeply involved in these kinds of crimes against all of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And, another part of that for me that comes up is perhaps less pressing right now, but that Portland is itself also a colonial city. And, it is also been an exclusionary city, and Oregon has been an exclusionary state for so long, with a law that was just finally broken down in 1926. And so what does taking this stance in a city, in another place, lead us towards here?
You're right. Portland has its own dark history of genocide and different kinds of racial discrimination. I think within 30 years of being quote-unquote discovered by Lewis and Clark, 95% of the indigenous population was exterminated. Since our founding as a territory, we had laws that said Black people couldn't even live here. So Portland's got a lot of injury that it's trying to heal already, and maintaining this symbolic partnership with another city founded on displacement just undermines these stated commitments to restorative justice, indigenous sovereignty.
What's it going to take, in your opinion, for an end to genocide in Gaza and for people to even acknowledge that's what that is?
Yeah. Well, I don't have the answer. Nobody does. If anybody knew how to stop this genocide, they would have already. The reality is that we have all suffered under decades and decades and billions of dollars of propaganda that aims to dehumanize Palestinians. So we're all on a steep learning curve with this genocide being broadcast live daily. And for some, it was an abrupt awakening and very obvious, and others are taking longer to see the truth. Palestinians know this so well. They've suffered under this system for 77 years, and they know exactly how hard it is to get people to see them as fully human. So some level of being able to roll with disappointments is part of this. But the BDS movement, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction, has been around for 20 years, and it is very effective. And Portland has an opportunity to engage with a boycott kind of way with this sister city relationship, which is not entrenched. It's not a permanent thing. What has to happen is city council needs to bring a resolution, and they need to vote on it. So a city council, the sister city relationship can be dissolved with a resolution and 7 votes in the affirmative.
You've been listening to an interview with Rebecca Ivy Galvan, a Portland resident who started a petition to end the sister city relationship between Portland and Ashkelon, Israel.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
All we hear is Radio Gaga.
We are proud to announce exciting news. KBOO Community Radio has been voted the best radio station in Portland by Willamette Week readers. In June, Willamette Week held a citywide